The Beatles' Help, the title song from the fifth album by a little band out of Liverpool, released 50 years ago, and it kind of coincided with an historic concert tour of North America, launched in August of 1965. What an interesting time that was. 56,000, warm evening in New York Shea Stadium. Imagine the scene, a pulsing, throbbing, wild crowd went crazy for a Beatles concert that changed everything. The band, like the UK and the US, was already undergoing a metamorphosis in some ways, and Help, as an album, was sort of a bridge between the first two phases of the band's career, a bridge to much more adventurous and personal songwriting, and it also sort of saw the seeds of the end. But what a ride it was, what it must have been like to be there in 1965 when the band just tore through the US and Canada. And nothing was ever the same in the music business and in many other aspects of modern life. I told you about this amazing book last year, Two. It was described in its foreword as a beautiful work of art, as close as you can get to being there, which is exactly what it was, maybe more. In a moment, guest Chuck Gunderson, who's put this book together. I should also warn you, we're having some technical problems, at least on my end. So if we lose, stay with us, we'll fix it. Hello, everyone. Sorry about that. I was trying to tell you during that last segment we were having some technical problems and my headset just sort of went out. But our team there on the other end has fixed the problem, so I apologize for that. Hope you stuck around because Chuck Gunderson is back. And as I was saying before, this book, this two-volume book, Some Fun Tonight, is a beautiful piece of work. And what an interesting time for the whole world 1965 was. Chuck, welcome back to the program. Sorry about that. Chuck, are you there? Boy, we're having a time here. I
Hello?
am open to suggestions here. Chuck, are you there?
I'm here.
Great, awesome, great. I'm really glad to hear your voice because we're having a heck of a time. But you've been around radio and you know what it's like. So it's really great to have you back. I read the book again. Got it last year and read it and loved it and read it again to prepare for this. And that description in the foreword about it being a work of art really is close to the mark because there's so much stuff. It's more than just a history of those Beatle tours because it's so visual. And that sort of goes to how you started. I mean, you were a collector of memorabilia, and that's how you got started down this road, right?
Yeah, I've been a collector of memorabilia, especially the touring memorabilia, for many, many years. And I'm also have a master's in history and a big Beatles fan. And everything just aligned up. And no one had really done a book on the history of the North American tours, the 3 years that they toured America. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to do it, but I want to do it my way and put all the stuff in it in terms of, hundreds of never-before-seen photos and memorabilia and contracts and documents and everything that I could think of, so to make it that work of art.
Well, that becomes a challenge when you're putting out a book or publishing a book is how much you put into it because it's got to be expensive. I mean, to include all the stuff that you did, it's so visual.
Yeah, I had to license every photo of that. Luckily, the memorabilia that's presented in the book is basically mostly from my collection. But yeah, you have to license everything. But because I'm a huge Beatle fan and I didn't want to cheat other Beatle fans out, I wanted to give them everything, and I had originally started with a one-volume project of about 320 pages, and it just morphed because I had found stuff that had been lost in the vaults for decades and finally unearthed it and presented it in the book. And so it went to two volumes and over 600 pages, and we even threw it in a really nice, attractive slipcase as well.
Let's talk about that time, sort of have you set the stage, set the scene. Because 1965, it's an interesting period. The Beatles had already conquered America, 1964, Ed Sullivan, the tours that you talked about, the tour that you talked about the last time you were here. What was the significance of 1965? I've said a couple of times in teasing your appearance that it changed everything for the music industry, but I mean, it changed much more than just music. It was so much going on, so much upheaval socially.
Yeah, it really was. And just in the music world in 1965, I mean, really quickly, let's just look at some of the highlights. It was just an amazing year. I mean, of course, you had Hullabaloo premiering, you had Berry Gordy Jr.'s Motown just climbing up the charts with the Temptations and My Girl. You had the Supremes with three number one hits in the same year. Dylan goes electric at the Newport Folk Festival in July. Of course, the Beatles' Help is released in August. They had previously released another album in June called Beatles 6. These are American releases. And, of course, towards the end of the year, you have The Who releasing My Generation, which is an all-time iconic song. And, of course, probably the most iconic song of 1965, the Rolling Stones' Satisfaction. And then finally, to end the year out of that beautiful year of 1965, Rubber Soul gets released in December. And that just changed everything.
You know, I mentioned in the beginning of the program about Help, how, you know, there are critics, and I know you're not a music critic, you don't want to get into that stuff, but there are critics who look at that and they just kind of discard it. I was not only just liked the album, but thought it was important. It was sort of like a bridge between the two eras, you know. They're not the cutesy pop-top guys after Rubber Soul and Revolver, and this is the album that sort of got them there. And any album that has Yesterday in it is not a lightweight album.
I completely agree with you, George. Yeah, in 1965, the Beatles released three albums. So Beatles 6 in June, which is a great album. I mean, one of my favorites, actually, and it's really not talked about a lot. And then a couple months later, of course, Capitol Records releases the Help movie soundtrack album. Just fantastic work. I mean, new compositions by Lennon and McCartney. You know, George Harrison, Ringo Starr doing all those great drum fills and patterns. And then, of course, you know, at the end of the year, Rubber Soul gets released, and that really shook up the music world. If I were to stack up the three albums, George, being a Beatles fan, I think I'd have to pick Rubber Soul over Help, I'm sorry to tell you. But in their own right, all three albums are brilliant.
Well, I have those discussions, music discussions with friends of mine, and there are those who think you have to pick a favorite, and they passionately defend theirs. It was the same kind of argument you'd have: are you a John Lennon guy or a Paul McCartney guy? And I've never felt like I had to be boxed in to make that kind of choices. Can't I like all of it?
I totally agree with you. Usually people talk to rabid Beatle fans like myself, and they ask me the question, you know, who's your favorite Beatle? There's no way I'm ever going to ask that, answer that question. And then they also ask me, well, what's your favorite song or album? And I can't tell you that either, because it is different every day. It depends on how I wake up, what my mood is like, what I'm going through in my life at that time. And those are the songs that fill my life soundtrack.
Just the idea, you mentioned the three albums in a year, that kind of output, it's just unheard of. I mean, it was probably unheard of then. It's certainly unheard of now.
Well, we know their first album, when they recorded in the UK, they had basically about 10, 12 hours to do the album. You know, you get groups now that there's 2 or 3 years between albums. And they herded the Beatles into a recording studio and said, go. And they just cranked out those songs. But the reason they were able to do that was because of their concert and stage repertoire. I mean, they had done this so much. They knew each other so well and how their musical styles went that it was easy for them just to come into a studio and crank that stuff out.
I don't know if you're comfortable in looking at the sociological stuff or of the era, the times kind of a thing, but what was going on there? We posted a link to the video, the film footage from Shea Stadium. We'll talk about Shea, that concert, in a minute. But you see the crowds going crazy, just similar to what had happened in 1964, just beyond excitement. It was some kind of frenzy. I don't know if it's something that was pent up or what was going on or whether you have your own explanation, but I sure hope you'd take a crack at it.
It's a tough crack to take, because before the Beatles, you know, there were obviously music stars where fans went crazy for. I mean, Elvis being one of them. But I think the big difference is that Elvis was one guy, you know, to look at, whereas the Beatles were four distinct personalities, individuals with different musical styles and tastes. And it took all of them to create this band, and then what happened was is fans started adopting favorite Beatles. You would go to a concert, and there would be signs for John and Paul and George and Ringo, and as a matter of fact, when the Beatles toured America for the first time in 1964, believe it or not, Ringo was the most popular Beatle. I mean, there were obviously there was a presidential election going on between Johnson and Goldwater, and fans made up signs said Ringo for president.
Well, I remember jumping ahead that after the band broke up, when Ringo was on his own, he was the one who came out with a string of hits more than any of the other guys, at least for the first couple of years.
Yeah, he did, and that was quite surprising. Of course, he had his fellow bandmates help with the music backing and lyrics and things like that. But yeah, Ringo was the first Beatle to really shine in the solo years.
Well, let's go back to 1965, actually maybe to 1964, because when you were here last, you described those concerts, that concert tour. One of the stops was here in Las Vegas, which is, we did a lot of stories to mark the 50th anniversary. What's the significance of what happened in 1965? I guess maybe how is it different from 64, and what did they learn on that one?
Yeah, well, the 64 tour was just pandemonium. I mean, they had played the Ed Sullivan shows. They played the Washington Coliseum in Carnegie Hall in early February. And so the time was right for them to come back in August. And their manager, Brian Epstein, he organized an incredible tour. I mean, they played 32 shows in 33 days, crisscrossing all over America and Canada, including your home, George, Las Vegas, Nevada, where they sold out the convention center for two shows. And once that 64 tour finished, they had raked in well over $1 million. You know, they had played close to 500,000 fans. And as a matter of fact, when you saw them in 1964, the average ticket price was $4.50. So, you know, when they came back, the cities that missed them, you know, they were really pent up to see these guys in person. Of course, they're going to play the major cities like New York, Chicago, and L.A. every time that they come to America. But they're also going to play a handful of regional cities as well. So they braced themselves for Beatlemania in 1965.
But they learned some things. You write in the book about how Brian Epstein, for the 64 tour, he was a little bit conservative. I mean, he didn't want to overdo it. He didn't want to have empty seats. So he looked for venues with, I think you said, 17,000 seats or less, something like that. 1965 was different, right?
Yeah, Brian Epstein was a brilliant manager, and anybody that says he wasn't is not correct. I mean, here was a guy who was a Jewish man, gay man, living in a port city in Liverpool, England, who discovered four guys and told them that one day they were going to be bigger than Elvis. So after the 64 tour, and when they started the 64 tour, Brian was offered so many huge venues. I mean, he was offered the L.A. Coliseum, 80,000 seats. He was offered Tiger Stadium, 50,000 seats. He was even offered Shea Stadium as early as the spring of 1964. And generally, when we talk about rock and roll managers, we tend to think of them as money grubbers and taking advantage of their artists. But Brian really believed in the Beatles, and he loved them and respected their music and respected their image. And so instead of money grubbing and taking all those venues that were huge, Brian decided to play it conservatively, and he booked smaller arenas around the country. They only played three stadiums in North America in 1964. And so what he created was this pent-up demand. And when they came back in 1965, it just unleashed in New York at Shea Stadium.
So 1965, you also have critics who the year before they'd said, this is a fad, this will fade, these guys are terrible. No one can like this music. Bring back Sinatra, that kind of stuff. Did they change their tune?
Yeah, most of them did. If you read the 1964 reviews of the concert by music critics in various papers around the country, they pretty much dismissed them. They pretty much said this was a passing fad. It was a sociological experiment, you know, that type of thing. But when they came back in 1965 and opened their tour at New York Shea Stadium to the tune of 55,600 seats, which really ushered in modern stadium rock concerts, okay? The Beatles were the first to do it. Sure, Elvis had played the Cotton Bowl in the late 50s to a tune of about 26,000 people. But to sell a stadium out completely by a rock and roll band was simply unheard of in that day. And it really took some convincing to get them to play there. When Sid Bernstein was the promoter, he was a local New York guy, and he had had the Beatles play in Carnegie Hall in 1964, and he told Brian Epstein, he said, you know, when you come back to America, I want you to play Shea Stadium. And Brian just scoffed at the idea. And so Sid got the point across by saying, Brian, I will promise you now, if you let the Beatles play Shea Stadium, I will pay you $10 for every unsold seat. So he never had to pay Brian 10 bucks because every seat in Shea was sold that night.
I imagine they were still nervous about it. They knew they were big. They knew that America loved them. But the band members themselves, not to mention their manager, had to be a little nervous going into it.
Yeah, there was a lot of tension behind stage before they went on at Shea. The first thing that happened is that they were staying over at the Warwick Hotel in Midtown Manhattan. And there was a problem that arose because they figured, how are we going to transport the Beatles from the hotel over to Flushing Meadows or the Queens section of New York, because you kind of have to go through the tunnels to get there. And they assumed that usually what happens when Beatle limousines take off, the fans take off in pursuit and follow them, try to run them off the road. And they thought that they would clog the tunnels going over there. So they, at the last minute, hatched this idea to leave the hotel and drive them down to the Wall Street heliport, where they got on a helicopter and flew over to Shea Stadium, which was the World's Fair site. So they landed right there where the World's Fair building was. And they were quickly transported to a armored vehicle where a Wells Fargo agent actually deputized them with badges, Wells Fargo agent badges, that they later put on their performing coats that night. And they went to the player's entrance, and then they had to kind of just hunker down there for several hours, kind of waiting for this concert to begin. I mean, you can imagine what they were feeling. I mean, the biggest audience they'd played to date probably was about 20,000-25,000, and now they're looking at double this amount, just this frenzied audience. And so, you know, they spent a lot of nervous hours behind stage, you know, passing time, and a lot of luminaries were down there. Mick Jagger and Keith Richard were down there.
It sort of feels like it's in a bunker. I've seen some of the photos you've got in the book, and, man, it looks claustrophobic. We're talking with Chuck Gunderson about his book, excellent two-volume book, Some Fun Tonight. Here's another piece from 1965's Help album. We'll be right back with more. That's, of course, the Beatles' Ticket to Ride, one of the songs from the album Help. I mentioned before that album, the title song was a hit. This one was a huge hit in 1965. The same album had another tune you may have heard of before called Yesterday, among others. I Need You, The Night Before. It's a great album. They had three good albums, as my guest Chuck Gunderson just mentioned, three hit albums in the 1 year. Punctuated by an amazing tour of North America. They had adventures pretty much at every stop on that tour, unique situations caused by their overwhelming popularity, and we're going to get into some of those right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Chuck Gunderson's two-volume book is a work of art, as I said. It's called Some Fun Tonight, and it goes step by step through all of the concert stops that were made by the Beatles, 64 through 66. We're looking at the 50th anniversary of the 65 tour, which started, at least in North America, with Shea Stadium. Chuck, we've talked about it a little bit. Set the stage again, though, how important that was, how it changed the idea of rock concerts, pop concerts for the ages. I mean, it changed everything.
Yeah, it did, George. And for some reason, it seemed like New York City was just the epicenter of everything Beatle. And it would have been interesting had they started the tour in 65 in another city in a large stadium, and if they would have sold that out, it'd be interesting to speculate. But when they came to New York and played that first show, of course, they started on the Ed Sullivan Show in 65 again on the 13th of August, and then they played Shea on the 15th of August. 55,600 people show up to this thing. It ushers in basically the modern rock, you know, stadium concert touring industry. Once promoters saw that they could fill stadiums and bands saw that they could fill stadiums, there was just dollar signs going everywhere. And it would be interesting to speculate, George, that if the Beatles did not have a successful show at Shea and didn't sell it out that night, would we would had Woodstock, would have Altamont happen, would have Watkin Glen's happen, would have Live Aid happened? I don't know. I think it would be really interesting to speculate. But when they sold that out, it just changed everything.
We posted the link to Vimeo of the concert, the Shea concert. You look at that film footage, it's just gorgeous. I mean, it is so up close and the color is so vivid. It really does seem like you're there.
Yeah, it does. And it was specifically filmed. I mean, this concert was designed to be filmed for later release. And so they had the best movie cameras available for this. I mean, they shot it in really high-quality film. The problem was the audio, because trying to record a Beatles concert, like George Martin, their record producer, said, was trying to record a band playing behind a 747 jet. You know, you just couldn't hear that music, behind the or in front of the screens. And so, interestingly enough, what happened was there were several tracks that just did not sound good in the movie. So what the Beatles had to do, believe it or not, was to go into a recording studio and record over some of those bits and pieces that did not sound good in the film. So when you're watching the film, most of that is recorded in a sound studio.
I remember you talking about the 64 tour and writing about it, and you had told me that, you know, you can see it in the footage. They can't hear themselves think. They can't hear their instruments. They can't hear anything over the sound of the screaming. They tried to make that different this time by having some kind of, like, speakers on the stage with them. Did it work?
Yeah, well, in everywhere they played, even in America in 1964, I mean, basically what they're doing is when they set up the equipment, they're just plugging into the public address system. So what you're hearing is the music just piped out through the arena speaker or the stadium speaker, and it was the same at Shea Stadium in 1965. They plugged it into the PA, and there they went. So what's really interesting about that was during that time there was not the invention of what they called fold-back speakers or monitors on stage, which is prevalent of obviously in the recording and concert industry today. It's, you know, when a group stands on stage and plays, these speakers on the stage point back to them so they can hear what they're singing. So how the Beatles ever heard themselves in Shea Stadium, you know, how Ringo ever kept a backbeat, I will never know. And there's a great mystery that's kind of surrounded this particular technology, and that's when they went down and they played the newly built Atlanta Stadium on August 18th, 1965. So they start in Shea, they sold out concert, they travel up to Toronto's Maple Leaf Gardens. It's a lousy system. Maple Leaf Gardens is an old venue, indoor venue. And then they go to this newly built Atlanta Stadium, and the sound was provided by a local company called Baker Audio, which is a great company. They had the latest in sound technology. They had wired Atlanta Stadium. They knew what they were doing. And their goal that night, George, was to crank out 500 watts of music, of sound. Okay, which is ridiculous. When Paul McCartney goes out and tours today, he tours with about 300,000 watts of sound. Most great home stereo systems can crank out 500 watts. Well, that was the goal. And Baker Audio claims that they were the first to ever place fold-back speakers on stage in Atlanta. And when you hear that concert on audio sound, you hear both Paul McCartney and John Lennon commenting on how good the sound was that night. Well, in researching the book, no one had really seen photos from Atlanta. Now, you would think there would be photos all over the place, you know, because now we live in the age of social media. But back then, they sent photographers, and, you know, they did their news stories, and they shot photos, and they would usually use one for the newspaper, and then they would toss the other ones. So photos are really hard to find. So when I finally found the photos from the Atlanta show, sure enough, I looked on stage, and it was the standard stage setup that they had in 1964, 1965, and 1966. There was no fold-back monitors or sound monitors on stage. And many of the music people that I've talked to in researching the book said that the technology just wasn't available back then. So Baker may have provided a very primitive fold-back speaker that was situated on the field, maybe 20 feet or so away, pointing back at them, but it would have not done what fold-back speakers do today.
There's a quote in the book, though. You have Paul McCartney as saying, as soon as they turn that on, as he's going, "Wow, this is loud," or something to that effect, right?
Yeah, he says, "Wow, it's," or he just says, "Ooh, it's loud, isn't it?" And then he says, "Great." And then right before John Lennon introduces another song, he said, "Hey, great, we can finally hear ourselves." So my theory is that when they played Atlanta Stadium, again, they'd played Shea 55,000. They'd gone into a primitive arena at Toronto Maple Leafs Gardens, which is an old arena built in the 20s. They come down to this newly built Atlanta Stadium that seats 55,000 people. Well, only 32,000 people show up to the concert. So you have lots of seats that are open. It's a nighttime concert. The sound carried really well. And it's just a decibel mathematical problem here. Baker created a lot of decibels with their sound and watts and things like that. And I think everything just equaled a perfect storm that night where the Beatles could actually hear themselves that night.
One of the big other big changes that you note in these books is about rider agreements. Now, we hear about these divas these days who put all kinds of ridiculous demands on the promoters. You know, "I don't want yellow M&Ms and that kind of stuff. I want jelly beans. I want a bottle of this and a bottle of that," and all kinds of crazy, ridiculous stuff. The Beatles made some demands themselves, a lot about security. What kind of things were in that rider agreement that jump out at you? And I should mention that that's one of the cool things about the book, is it's not just news photos that you have in there. You have ticket stubs from all these stops. You have all kinds of promotional things and posters, but you also have the actual contracts and agreements, and in a lot of cases, the dollar figures about how much they were paid and how much the promoters made, right down to dollars and cents.
Yeah, that's right, George. And those are some of the most interesting things I think I found for the book is, you know, tour riders from all 3 years and, like you said, balance sheets and things like that. But what really changed from 64 to 65 was this. In 1964, their rider was about a page and a quarter, okay? Most bands, when they tour today, I mean, they're voluminous, you know. They're several pages of what they want in the dressing room and how they want the sound and everything. Every I is dotted, every T is crossed. So in 1965, when the Beatles came back, of course, they learned a lot. I mean, Brian Epstein really kind of invented the rock and roll massive touring industry, and he doesn't get credit for it, sadly. They were kind of inventing things as they were going along, trying to figure this out. So when they come back in 1965, they added from an original page and a quarter to a page and a half. So what they did is, you know, Brian, instead of wanting 100 policemen at every event in 1964, he actually added 50 more. So they had 150 policemen at every event. He also added the actual dimensions of the stage, because a lot of promoters were putting together these flimsy stages that weren't up to par for the Beatles standards. Lastly, one of the things he did, and you mentioned it, George, I mean, when stars tour today, they want this type of food, they want this type of water to drink, you know, everything. What the Beatles added in 1964 that they didn't even ask for in 1964 was this: four cots, yeah, a mirror, a portable TV set, and clean towels in their dressing room. And then lastly, I think the biggest thing that they invented, here we go, another Beatles invention, was they finally invented a primitive backstage pass, which today is prevalent in the touring industry. In 1964, they had no idea who was at the hotels, the venues, the press conferences. They had no way to control these things. And so finally, Brian Epstein's press manager, Tony Barrow, came up with the idea of having an identification pass. And it was a little cardboard pass that they issued to the support acts that were along for the tour, the various tour personnel, and various people that were involved with planning the tour. And so these people were issued passes, and so if they wanted to get anywhere near the Beatles, they needed to show that pass. So the Beatles did invent the backstage pass.
You also, in one of the writers that you include in the book, it mentions about, hey, we want to know who's getting comps. We want to know who's getting comp tickets. There should be a limit on it of 50 comp tickets per event, and we want to see a list of who's on it. Because as you note elsewhere in the book, they were kind of ticked off at the idea of kind of fat cats and cops and people who had connections all getting freebie tickets to the detriment of the regular fans.
Yeah, they always hated when they flew into a city. The first people that would usually be on the plane were the police officers that were charged that day to secure them. And they would all be, of course, wanting their autographs and to talk to them and take pictures and things like that. In 1964, Brian gave away 100 comp tickets per concert, which is, you know, in today's standards, is, you know, there's lots more that are issued today. But in 1965, he limited it to 50 comp tickets. But it's interesting because I uncovered a document for the 1965 Hollywood Bowl show in Los Angeles, California. This was towards the end of the tour. And it's interesting to see some of the people that were on the list. And the promoter, who was Bob Eubanks, later of Newlywed Game fame as the host, he actually sold the promotion of that show to his radio station that he worked for, KRLA. And KRLA provided a list that I saw that I printed in the book showing all these people getting comp tickets. I think they had to give away close to 1,500 comp tickets. On the list, Sonny Bono was on the list, but I think the most interesting person on the list was Mr. Frank Sinatra. And in parentheses, not only did he want 50 comp tickets, but in parentheses it said, the best in the house. Chairman of the board.
It's interesting, too, the security arrangements. I mean, they were pretty security conscious after what they went through in 64. You mentioned before about how they had they were using armored cars here and there, and there were times they feared for their lives. I mean, a lot of times.
Yeah, they did. And, you know, every city that they played in all 3 years were usually, they had to go into decoy cars. They were in laundry trucks. They were in fish trucks. They were in moving vans, ambulances, just all kind of things, because the fans were always trying to get to them. They always had decoy limousines that the fans could chase after so they could slip safely out in an ambulance under a sheet. And the hotels had to be secured. The press conferences had to be secure. And, you know, the airports had to be secure. And they had a frightening experience when they traveled to Houston on that 1965 tour. I mean, the plane doesn't even get there until 2 a.m. You know, they had just played that concert in Atlanta that we just talked about. They fly into Houston. There's 5,000 fans at 2 a.m. at the Houston airport. The plane comes into taxi, and the fans just overwhelmed the police. They ran onto the tarmac while the plane is still taxiing. Okay, and they had chartered an aircraft from American Flyers Airlines. So it was a turbo, you know, I mean, not a turbo, but four propellers spinning. And you have fans running onto the tarmac. Some of them are smoking. You know, the plane's moving. And finally, when the plane came to a rest, I mean, fans were climbing onto the wings, trying to look into the windows. So airport officials had to scurry around, and they got one of those elevated baggage carts. They brought it up to the rear exit of the plane and elevated it up to the height of that door, and the Beatles and their entourage had to jump onto this elevated baggage cart. I have an image of it in the book. It's fantastic. and take them safely to the airport terminal while the fans were even chasing that and throwing things at them.
You mentioned about the cost of the ticket for the 1964 concerts. That's one of the coolest part of the books is that you've got tickets from pretty much all the shows. I can't imagine anyone parting with their ticket stubs from those shows, but somehow you got them, and I imagine there's probably a market out there, a thriving market for them. But the cost of tickets, even after the success of the 1964 tour, the cost was ridiculously low.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing what, you know, Brian Epstein really, I think, gave fans value for their money. He didn't really gouge them, and in 1964, you could have saw him for an average ticket price of $4.50. At one show at Forest Hills in the tennis stadium there in Queens in New York, you could have saw him for $1.95. And when they came back in 1965, Brian, the average ticket price only raised by about 30 cents. So $4.80 to see the Beatles in 1965, really at the height of their stardom.
Wow. You know, the Beatles, in reading books about them, they had that same philosophy with the records. They would release a single. They wanted two A-sides. They didn't want to give a B-side. They wanted to be a power-packed bargain for the fans.
Exactly. They wanted to do that for the fans. I mean, look at, I mean, the fans were loyal to them. They're going to be loyal back and try to give them the best value for their money.
Well, they had some hair-raising adventures along the way. We started talking about Shea Stadium and that show, and then Toronto and Atlanta, and a close call in Houston, problems with airports, but there were other problems along the way. And got perilously close to a scandal, I guess, and was it Minneapolis? But where there's a headline that we're going to talk about that you reprint in the book that talks about what goes on at night with these guys. I can't imagine that I'm sure they would like to have had all kinds of hanky-panky and mischief, but I'm not sure that they would. It would probably risk their lives to go out of the hotels to mess around. So we're going to get into that and go sort of step by step through the tour, talk a little bit about some of the other acts that went along with them, King Curtis and Brenda Holloway, and a lot more here to come. My guest is Chuck Gunderson, talking about his book Some Fun Tonight, the 1965 tours of the Beatles as the focus, and a lot more to come here on Coast to Coast AM.